You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 13th of November 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, we've been away for a week, but it's Wednesday once again, and that means that we have with us revisionist historian Carolyn Yeager from carolynyeager.net. Carolyn, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Sven. I'm doing real well. I want to tell you it's freezing here this morning, literally. Freezing, which is a little bit early for that, but I see the sun has just come out, so it's going to warm up a little bit.
Going to be a nice day eventually. For you. It's cold here as well.
Yeah,
it's freezing
ice,
cold here.
I had ice on my porch railings this morning. So
the winter
there you
is
go.
Here. The winter is here, and of course, us coming from northern climes, we don't have a problem with that. And we're going to be hearing more about Germany later on today. The last couple of chapters from the Hitler Youth instruction manual, all about agriculture. But first, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about something that President Macron has been saying at a peace forum. Is that right?
Right. I just saw it this morning on the news. He just said it. He said it Tuesday at this Paris Peace Forum. You know, this Macron, he's, in my opinion, he's the water carrying boy for the globalist structure of the world. And when Trump became president, was elected, which was a surprise to everyone. Well, Macron tried real hard to make good friends with Donald Trump. And then he invited Trump to France for a big state visit and all. And, all the stops were pulled out and on Bastille Day, and they had a big parade and all this stuff. And so Trump was going along with it, and they were like, buddy, buddy. But then ever since Trump does his thing, which is doesn't make the globalist internationalists happy at all. And Macron has tried to keep friendly and act like everything was just fine, but he's sort of unable to continue to do that. So now he's coming out with a little bit stronger criticism. And I think that what it's saying is that that populism is making such headway and seeming to be pretty well entrenched. So the powers that be in the running the world decided they need to come out more strongly against this populism. And that includes what Trump is doing. And Macron has been making stronger anti-USA noises. And I think he may have given up on trying to influence Donald Trump, because he's a little guy like him is certainly not going to influence Donald Trump, as they have come to see. That's not even bringing up what Trump's going through with this impeachment bullshit that's going on in our country, but that's not going to go anywhere anyway. So Macron makes these statements what I think are really interesting and fit in with what I'm going to talk about with the National Socialist programs back in Hitler's day. And he says that we're now experiencing an unprecedented crisis in our international system. I just love that they call it the international system. Well, they think that sounds good. They have got all these countries to go along and fit in with this international system. It's kind of generally under the UN, but the UN is weak. So it's really under, various European system, along with the UK system. But now the UK is breaking loose. And so everything is, and Donald Trump is not being persuaded to change, to stop what he's doing. In fact, he's going more so. So they're losing out here. And so Macron has to come to the rescue and make the talk about it. He's saying that new inequalities between people and countries have prompted a rise of nationalism, even among those who are the last resort guardians of this international system. So, of course, he means the United States, he means the UK, and he means some European nations like Italy and well, they're all, even in Germany, you have the AfD. So they're all got very strong populist movements and moving away from this international system that's got a stranglehold on us for all these years since World War II. says in apparent reference to U.S. President Donald Trump's policies, Macron commented that the temptation of unilateralism is very risky. Well, of course, Donald Trump is pushing unilateralism for the United States and saying, we're going to do this and you can, go along with that. But we're not going to support you financially for doing things that are not in our interest and things like that. So this is, very risky to the system. And we tried, Macron said, made this statement. We tried that option in the past. It leads to war. Nationalism is war. So, he's criticized nationalism before, but now he's come out even stronger with this. And, going right up against what they're calling populism now, which is the latest form of nationalism, really. And he recently criticized NATO, talked about the brain death of NATO. And he was criticized for that. But anyway, he said this now, and then EU Commission President-elect Ursula von der Leyen, who still hasn't taken office yet for some reason, said that she came out in support of him and said that multilateralism had created a Europe that was peaceful and united and was settling differences around the tables rather than in between trenches. That's their whole argument. Europe was filled with war. They brought about the war. They caused those wars, those terrible world wars. And now they're saying, well, because of these world wars, we have to have a world government. So, but Trump is not causing war. He's settling differences peacefully in his own way. He's the greatest statesman on the planet today. It's just like with Hitler. They made Hitler out to be the enemy of everything good, and Hitler was the greatest statesman in his time. Now, Trump is the greatest statesman, and he's being criticized from all angles and even compared to Hitler. So, but he's doing this himself because he's got the right idea. I'm just extremely supportive of him. Even if he plays nice with with Israel, we just have to overlook that because everything he's doing is right and is going in the right direction. So this brings me to this book that I've been posting for the last, I don't know how many of them. Oh, I've been, chapter 13 is the last one. So 13 weeks, 13 very different posts, not every week, from what's called the Handbook for Schooling the Hitler Youth. And I found out that this book you can buy it today. It's sold as the Nazi Primer and the Handbook for the Hitler Youth. But the main title is the Nazi Primer. And I found out that it's a translation by an Englishman made for the English people who were pro-Hitler, but they titled it for some reason, the Nazi primer. The real title of it in Germany, and it is material prepared for the Hitler Youth. The Hitler Youth was quite a large and competent organization on its own behalf, and it produced all kinds of material, and it was always in line with what Adolf Hitler was saying, and you know, it wasn't a rogue in any way, and so this was material that was put together from Hitler Youth material by a guy named Beneke. That's a German name. He was the editor, along with a person whose name was Gierlich, and it was titled, in translation, The German People and Their Habitat, Manual for the Training of the Hitler Youth. But when the English publishers published it, which was nice that they did it for the English people, English audience, they changed the name to The Nazi Primer. I can't really understand why they would use the word Nazi there. But I haven't found any, I might not have all the information, but I haven't found any other copies of it that weren't called the Nazi Primer. And then in the subtitle was Handbook for Schooling the Hitler Youth, which is good, but the other Nazi Primer is not a good title, but that's what they did. That's best I know, and so that answers that question. But you can buy it on Amazon or from other booksellers. What I like about it is that it shows that the under Adolf Hitler, this was in 36 and 37, I don't know, around in the mostly I think came out maybe in 36. So it came out in this English translation came out in Munich, and here it says Munich, the German, in 1937. But the material would have been prepared earlier than that. Anyway, it shows that they were teaching the youth in an honest way, you know, in accurate way. They weren't pushing any of these wild beliefs about Adolf Hitler's regime and under what National Socialism did in Germany that were, you know, against the German people and against all the Jews and blah, blah. It doesn't have that. It has the history of the Germans, the importance of race and blood and soil, and the importance of Germany being united and working together for its welfare and its survival, because this is after World War One, of course. And I'm just going to start with the chapter 12, the soil as a source of food supply, because you know the chapter 12 and chapter 13 get into these raw material resources and stuff, and lots of detail about what Germany had, and almost so many people are interested in that. And I there's a lot to be learned from these, so that's why I'm talking about them today especially. And some of the points made in this were giving the rationale for self-sufficiency for Germany at that time in the 30s, after World War One, and before they even thought there would be a World War II. They didn't plan or want to have World War II. They wanted to go on continuing to develop Germany. And so one of the reasons for self-sufficiency, which went against this globalist, why it ties in with what I talked about earlier, it goes against the globalist idea that everyone is interconnected and you have to rely on other countries for part of your, you know, your trade. You have to rely on them, and they have to rely on you, so that you're not independent and you can't act alone. That's how they accomplished all this. And the Germans called it autarky. Hitler always called it autarky, which we would call like self-sufficiency in our nation state. And this was so important to Hitler because of what happened in World War One and the blockade, which they have some figures here in this article that says as sacrifices to the enemy blockade, Germany lost 88,000 undernourished women, children, and old men in 1915. In 1916, 122 died from lack of food. In 1917, 260,000, and in 1918, 294,000. So, adding that up, it's approximately over 800,000, or just under 800,000. I'm not sure, but that's over 750,000 right there that succumbed to that blockade, and a lot of that was after the war was over, when the blockade continued for 6 months until Germany was willing to sign that Versailles Treaty, which they originally did not want to sign. And the original chancellor at the time refused to sign it. And he was replaced then with someone else who did sign it because the Germans were dying. As this article says, we will always experience this fate if we have not assured the feeding of our own people within our own territory. So Hitler made this a priority, and that's what they're talking about in this to the Hitler Youth in this booklet. They don't go into that. That is only that one sentence that talks about the losses from the blockade. The rest is all about how, you know, and says the quality of the soil in the German Reich is not equally good everywhere. In fact, most places it's not that good. Germany is known as not, they've made the best of it. They make the best of it. They do a lot of improvement. But just generally, they only have a few areas that have really quality soil. And then they lost them, some of their best areas, in the Versailles Treaty. And that's pointed out here, too. And it says the climate is not equally good everywhere either. They have some more mild areas, and then they have some more harsh type of weather areas where it's more extreme, you know, like every country has some, but some countries are far more productive than Germany without the German hard work going into it to make it more so. But what's interesting that rye, oats, and sugar beets were the most successful crops in Germany. Rye doesn't take very good soil, and it seemed like oats can grow in not that great a soil too. And sugar beets, I guess, also, although because the better areas, they would grow things like wheat and other products. But they needed to, as is well known, Germany needed to import a lot of food products. And the four-year plan that Hitler set out under Goering, maybe the agricultural plan was not under Goering, but, you know, was to make some changes. They did a lot of study and determined what they needed to do and how they could produce more things that they could eat without having to import so much, and to improve their import-export ratio and all of that. And then he points out how much they lost when they lost territory in Alsace-Lorraine to France after World War One, and Silesia and Sudetenland to Poland and Czechoslovakia. Germany's lost even more after World War Two, so they're down to a very small territory compared to what it once was. But even then, after World War One, they lost overall 11 million tons of potatoes, I guess, yearly, you know, from losing those lands that they would grow on. 3,200,000 hogs that they could raise in those areas, 2,600,000 head of cattle, 790,000 horses, and 535,000 sheep. And then they lost their German colonies in Africa, And they had put a lot of development into it. They weren't finished yet, but they lost what they were gaining in 42,000 hectares. I don't know what that is. It's similar to an acre of cocoa palms, 5,000 hectares of oil palms, 13,000 hectares of cocoa, 4,800 coffee, and 2,200 of bananas. So that's stuff that, you know, that they all helped them, you know, it helped them. They could export some of it and they could use it for a lot of things. And so, and then they also passed, Hitler also passed laws that helped German farmers, like the National Inheritance Law in 33, the Food Real Estate Law in 33. And what's most important, that at least the one I'm most familiar with, I don't have the year, but the law to which was, I don't know the name of it, but which was to prevent foreigners from purchasing German family farms and preventing family farms from dividing up the farm to the various members of the family, you know, the various children, because that just made the farm less able to function as a single entity and more likely to be sold to these wealthy foreigners who were coming in. A lot of them were Jews. And buying it up, which was taking land away from German ownership, which was very, very important, and he made the law that all family farms owned by Germans that had to be inherited by the oldest son, and there's a lot more that went on there. The others weren't left destitute or anything, but it was this helped. So all of this is part of this agricultural policies that Hitler put in place, that they're teaching, that they taught to their youth, which was all positive, you know, in my estimation. And I'm going to go to how much time? You want to make some comment? I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'll just say. What comes across there, which most people probably don't think about, is the loss of resources that were involved with that Versailles Treaty. Because you think, well, they lost this land, and you think, well, the people that were living there, they suddenly weren't a part of Germany anymore, and Germany lost these people. But you don't realize that land itself was filled with all the resources, not just the food that they needed, but the coal that they needed, the minerals that they needed, all these things that Germany as a whole needed to survive, were taken away from them, and they suddenly didn't have them. And that's before you get into, you know, the famine that was caused at the end of the first war. I mean, I'd never really thought about it in that way before until reading it there. And that's something that, people should really think about when they're thinking about this, and the way that, they dealt with it. They came up with Buna, was one of the ways with the innovation. Where they were short of rubber and petroleum, and it points it all out there, and also the fact that they were then banned from actually purchasing stuff from other countries because they weren't allowed to use foreign currency, which I guess would have been a part of this Jewish banking boycott of Germany. Is that right?
Yeah, it's all. I don't have all those details, and they don't go into it here that way. See, they're not. They're not blaming Jews. They're not. They do mention the banking thing, but you know, the punishments were so incredibly harsh, which is why the Germans were so angry and why they responded to Adolf Hitler the way they did when he laid all this out and said he was going to do something about it, and nobody else would do anything about it. They were tied, you know. They were either traitors, or they're not really, most of them were not traitors. They cared, but they didn't know how to go about it. Adolf Hitler knew how to go about it, and that's what made him an enemy. And they use all these attacks against him and against the German people, but they were just trying to recover and save their country. And yes, in the other article, the last one, chapter 13, talks about the industrial situation. And it was very interesting to me because I didn't know that much about it. And I'll just say here the things that Germany could export during the 30s before World War II took place, they started gaining back some territory, were hard coal, salt and calcium, and nitrogen fertilizer that they made, which was kind of from ammonia, which was, a byproduct of some of the coal stuff. And that was it. You know, it totaled 374 million Reichsmarks. But what they had to import was textile raw materials, fiber and yarn, ores and metals, wood and cellulose. Even though they have a lot of wood, they still didn't have enough without destroying their forests. They said in order to keep their forests healthy so that they would continue to have wood, they couldn't, you know, cut it all down, so they had to import some. And hides, leather, and felt from animals, mineral oils, India rubber, that's where they developed the Buna, and mineral phosphates and other raw materials, total 2,230.2 million Reichsmarks. So way more they had to export than they had to import than they could export. So they were struggling so badly. And when they lost by losing Alsace-Lorraine, Upper Silesia, as the some of the minerals that they lost, along with the food I mentioned, was 80% of their iron supplies, 70% of their zinc deposits, 64% of their Thomas meal production. I don't know what that is. Meal, I guess it's, I don't know. 41% of their lead, 26% of hard coal, 26% of calcium. See, they still had some hard coal and calcium, and they had plenty of soft coal. That's about it. 10% of their standing timber and 10% of their wool production and important petroleum resources. So there they were. And so that explains what was going on. I guess we've run out of time. But that explains what was going on and why Hitler did what he did. And they were explaining it to their youth who were in the Hitler Youth. These are the ones who were expected to be future leaders who, you know, would really serve Germany and the German cause and the German people. Those people, those ones in their nation, those young men and young women who were true patriots, and, you know, and they gave them a wonderful education, and they expected them to learn all this and to act in responsible ways. So I think it's just exceptionally impressive, and the people who do read it comment and say so. They're very impressed by what is in this handbook. So
there's a lot of information there. I would recommend listeners go and check it out and read it for themselves. And it amazes me that we have this, you know, this climate change movement that we have now, and it's so communist and it's against nationalism, but nationalism is self-sufficiency, and that's what these environmentalists want. They want us to be self-sufficient. They try to be self-sufficient in their homes. They try to be organic farmers, and all these things are nationalist ideas, and it's what the National Socialists were doing. And yet you've got Macron there saying nationalism is war. It's not. It is self-sufficiency. It's looking after your nation, and that's all the Germans were doing. And look at what happened to them for daring to try and look after their own people, which is, again, you know, you put that link there. That is what Donald Trump is trying to do. He's just standing up for America. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Carolyn. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.